tradition tells us that Lady Godiva rode through the streets of England town naked with the express purpose in mind she was going to persuade her husband to spare the people from oppressive taxes. Sounds bizarre, doesn't it? Not a whole lot more bizarre than some of the other crazy things that are going on. Outside of Bloomington, Indiana, where I lived for a few years, there is a nudist camp. A nudist camp, you heard me right. And it's under police protection. Our tax dollars protects these people. Live out there in the nude. Camp together. I have an article found several years ago written about some striptease artists in Boston. These women describe how the men just ache and they're just trying to get their hands on me. Bragging about it. Pornographic materials today is a multi-million dollar industry. Multi-million dollar industry. Commercials on TV, game shows, primetime programs, all of them sport women that are half clad, form-fitting clothes, suggestive activities, and we allow our eyes to feast on that regularly. Is it any wonder that rape and all other sexual sins is growing at such a rapid pace? I want to share with you. We're talking about attire tonight. I want to share with you some old statistics that Paul Harvey put together back, I think, in 1970 or thereabouts. You may have heard this before. Bear with me if you have. But I want to say to you, before I even go through them, there's a lot of parallels between 1970 and today. We'll get into that in just a moment. Paul Harvey said that girls' skirts started to go up in 1964. Now, if you just stop and think what we talked about this morning, it'll mean something to you. 1962, prayer was outlawed in public schools. Lots of changes began to take place. Morals began to decline immediately. In some cases, they were tripling every year. 2 years later, girls' skirts are going up. And as they're creeping up, some think it's a coincidence. I don't. Paul Harvey didn't either. Crimes against women were also escalating. FBI files show that the rate of forcible rape, which had been declining the previous 5 years, shot up in 1964 and every year since. That was until the late 60s. Right around 1970. In England, where the miniskirt had been introduced a few years before and had had its start, and what it was causing in the country itself, there was an increase of crime by 90%. In the United States, it increased at the same time, 68%, but a little bit later start these many clothes had in the United States. But those forcible rapes, those violent crimes were increasing pretty rapidly. I ask you the question, as Paula Harvey asked the question in that survey that he put together, is there a correlation? I think there is, and he took a consensus of 50 states, law enforcement officers in 50 states, and all of them, with no reservation, said yes. Professional law enforcement officers in 50 states were asked the question, a very specific question, does the short skirt invite sex crime? 61% of the major cities reported, and 92% of them said yes, it invites sex crime. At that point, 1970, Paul Harvey's writing, and he says, where forcible rape is now our nation's fastest increasing crime, he said a separate category of molestation of young girls is also increasing at a record rate. That's amazing. But you know what's behind all of that? Mary Quant, and this was again in Paul Harvey's little blurb that he wrote in 1970. She was asked, now here's, Mary Quant is the London designer of the miniskirt, mini clothes. She's the one that came up with the idea. And she was asked the question about these clothes. What's the purpose? And I'm quoting from her, and I want you to see what she said. She said, many clothes are symbolic of those girls who want to seduce a man. Let that really sink in. Pearl Harvey's predictions, or his figures, provide us a basis for predicting what's going to happen today. I want to share with you some facts that I found the other day in the FBI files. This is just over a four-year period, but I want to share with you what I found. This is let me show you these other figures first. I'm sorry. They agree, but it's still a problem today. Forcible rapes between 1970 and 1992 were up 349%, from 26,888 in 1970 to 93,825 in 1992. Now, let me share this with you. I found this in the files. Forcible rape. Look at the sharp increase that takes place between 1990 and 1992, and then the sharp decline that takes place from 1992 to 1994. Forcible rape. You know what happened in 1992? I'll tell you. Is there correlation? Yes, there is. 1992, you may well remember, that's when the baggy clothes came back in. That's when the longer dresses and skirts came back in. Now, is there a correlation? Paul Harvey was right. I'm going to be interested in seeing what happens in 1995 and 96, because the short skirts are coming back in. Those figures aren't available in the FBI files yet. They have them up to 93, and that's all. Ann Landers, a few years ago, and you've seen her make this comment several times, she warns girls about wearing clothes that turn boys on. I wish we had more Ann Landers out there warning us. what's going on. It's easy for us to compromise when the world seems to be all going the same way and the morals keep declining. But I want you to keep in mind what's behind all of this, as Mary Quant was quoted saying. The purpose behind many clothes is to seduce a man. Now, if a woman who's married to a husband wants to do that in her own bedroom, in her own house, that's one thing. We're not talking about that sort of thing. We're not talking about that at all. She was also asked the question, and I'll share this with you. She was asked, what's the point of fashion? Where is it leading? And she had a three-letter word that answered the question. Sex. That's where it's leading. That'll tell us something. As Christians, as people who are inclined to be morally right and morally good, on the right track, setting a good example, being a good pattern after which others can pattern their lives, think about the clothing that you wear. And I want you to really think with me tonight. Now, I'm not talking about wrong activities tonight. I'm talking about wrong attire. I'm talking about things that are too short, things that are too low, things that are too thin and transparent, things that are revealing. It's an obvious appeal to the fleshly man. And Christians have no business in that business. None at all. There's some Bible principles that we ought to be aware of come into play on this. There are three categories of moral issues. There are those things that are right because God commanded them. There are those things that are wrong because God forbids them. And then there are things that are indifferent. It's my judgment that's what we're talking about tonight. The latter one more than the other two. There are some concepts and scriptures that we have to pull into play here. But we're talking about some matters of judgment also. And I think largely that's where the issue is. But we'll deal with some concepts concerning what God expects of us also that come into play. But when these things are ignored, when these Bible principles are ignored, that's when the problem comes in. That's when we have the problems. Well, let's look at some scriptures together along that line. Matthew 5, Jesus makes a comment that I think has a lot to do with what we're talking about tonight. Matthew 5, verse 27. Jesus is in this mode in the Sermon on the Mount of comparing or contrasting, I should say, contrasting the old law with the new law. And he says, you've heard it said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Looking at a woman is one thing. Looking at a woman to lust for her is another. And that's what we're talking about. That's what Mary Quant's trying to do. That's what all these designers are trying to do. They want the men to lust. Jesus says, if you just do it in your heart, that's sufficient. That's sin. That's equal to the action itself. Just doing it in your mind. Doing it in your heart. It's a concept we cannot ignore. It's parallel to the sin itself. Proverbs, the 23rd chapter and verse 7. The writer says that, well, as we think in our hearts, so are we. That's what Jesus is saying. That's what Solomon said. Whatever you think in your heart, that's what you are.
You think adultery? It is adultery. You think good? It is good. What are we allowing our minds to feast on? What are we filling our hearts with is the question. Jesus in Matthew 15, verse 19, beginning. He says, "For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man. But to eat with unwashed hands does not defile a man." What are we filling our hearts with? What are we seeing on TV? What are we seeing on the streets? I know there's some of these things we cannot avoid. We're going to see it. I know that. You know that. But what we're filling our minds with, Jesus is saying, is what's going to come out. We'll allow our minds to feast on it, think about it. A little bit like the guy that said it's one thing to have a bird come and land on your head. It's another thing for him to allow that bird to build a nest in your hair. We might have a fleeting thought. You might see something we shouldn't see. But don't dwell on it. Get rid of it. Think about something else. Before sin enters, before it's mature, and there is sin, think about something else. That's what Jesus is saying here. We allow our minds to feast on these things, and obviously what's going to come out is evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. We cannot allow our minds to feast on things. We need to control our minds. There's an Old Testament example of what happens when these things are ignored. The priests in Exodus 20th chapter and verse 26 were prohibited. I just call this as a reference. They were prohibited from walking up the stairs to the altar to make sacrifice because they might show themselves. Now, priests at that point were wearing things similar to what women would wear today, so the legs would be exposed. And later in the book, he tells them they were supposed to wear bloomers, basically, something to protect them so they wouldn't be exposing their nakedness. Men, do you get the point? Men exposing their nakedness. I know I'm talking primarily to women tonight, but it's possible for men also to expose their nakedness. And in the Old Testament times, their legs, exposing their legs, consisted of nakedness. About those, and I don't even know you people, so I can speak pretty plainly. I don't know what you do. But how many people here, how many men here, are exposing their legs? Think about it. Think very soberly about it. It's wrong. Wrong, another Bible principle, to cause sin. Cause somebody else to sin because of something that we do. Jesus deals with this in Luke, the 17th chapter. Luke 17, the first couple of verses. Look what he has to say. He says, "It is impossible that no offenses should come." In other words, to think that there's not going to be any time when people will be offended, that is, not just hurt, cause to sin. It's impossible, Jesus said, that there's not going to be times like that. But woe to him through whom they do come. It's impossible that there's not going to be a time when there won't be people offended or cause to sin. But Jesus says, woe to the one who causes that offense, causes that sin. He says it would have been better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea than that he should offend one of these little ones. To be in the position as a Christian, as a servant of the Most High God, and to cause somebody to offend, to cause them to sin, it'd be better if we had a millstone hung around our neck and we were just cast out there in the sea and drowned. The Lord doesn't look lightly on those who cause sin. Go with me to Romans 14. Romans 14. Obviously, in this particular case, we're in the area of judgment. Paul is talking. But in verse 21, he says, "It is good neither to eat meat nor drink wine, nor do anything by which your brother stumbles or is offended or is made weak." Anything that you do, doesn't matter what it is, anything that you do that would cause your brother to stumble or be offended or made weak in any way, don't do it. That's what he's saying. It's good not to do it. He's a little bit more severe on that if you go on over to the 1 Corinthians letter. A little more plain about that. But I'm just saying that there are some categories here of Bible principles that we've got to really think about. Some principles we cannot ignore. So have those as a basis for the remainder of the lesson.
God has a design for Christians and their attire.
I don't want to talk about that with you tonight. Let me share some of the things that, in the first point, I want us to look at. The words modest, shamefast, sober, submissive, quiet, and meek. All of those are applied in others, but all of those are applied to women. Let's look at some scriptures together. 1 Peter, the 3rd chapter. Peter deals with some of these words. Let's look in the context of what he has to say. 1 Peter 3, verse 1 beginning. He says, "Wives, likewise be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives." Notice the power that Peter is talking about here, the power of submission. The submission of the wife to her husband, the power that that has in his life. He's saying here, even if they do not obey the word, their husbands, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. By the conduct. Not by what the woman is saying, not by how she haggles her husband into submission or tries to encourage him to become a Christian. Not that way. Peter's talking about by her conduct. The power of her submitting to her husband can have a great effect on that man. And that's what Peter's talking about. Look at verse 2 then. He says that they observe your, or when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Your husbands, when you have submitted to him, your husband, he's saying, is going to observe your chaste conduct, your godly conduct. They'll see that you're in subjection to the Lord also. There's a power there that a woman has just by submitting to her husband. Look at verse 3. "Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel." The outward is not the important things, Peter says. The extravagance that you might go to in attiring yourself, not important. Really, it's something you shouldn't be concerned about. Now, he's talking about extravagance here. So, what should be, though, is something else that's more powerful than that. He goes ahead in the next verse. "Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God." The outward is not the concern. Why is that not a concern? Because if the inward is right, the outward will take care of itself. That's why. Get the heart right, Jesus said, and things outside would be great.
Watch what we feed our heart on. The decisions that we make then will be reflected in our outward man, how we attire ourselves, rather than the reverse. We want to attire ourselves extravagantly on the outside, and what do we have inside? Not much. Not much. He goes ahead in verse 5 to say, "For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good, and are not afraid of any terror." I like Peter's choice of word there, "if you do good." That word refers to things that are morally right. Not just things that are helpful, not just things that are useful, things that are morally right before God. Not wrong, right. If you do good and are not afraid of any terror, look at what you can do for your husband. You can be a daughter. You can be a daughter of Sarah. A daughter of a godly woman. That's what he's saying. She trusted in God. Go to 1 Timothy, the second chapter. 1 Timothy, the second chapter. Verse 9. Well, let's begin with verse 8. "I desire therefore that the men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. In like manner also," verse 9, "that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but in which is proper for women, professing godliness, with good works. Let a woman learn in silence, with all submission," so forth. Verse 9, he's talking about modest apparel. That which is orderly, that which is becoming, that which is well arranged, that which is decent. That's the way the word is defined. You men, take note here, because these words that we're talking about here, we're going to talk about in relation to you in just a moment. These words also apply to you and me. But here we're talking about something that's well arranged, something that's decent. It's becoming. Becoming of a Christian. It reflects that you are a servant of God. That's what we're talking about. In verse 9, he uses the word shamefast. Now, I know some of your versions don't have that word. This version, the New King James Version, uses the word propriety. I think it's a shame that I didn't mean to play on words, but we've lost the word that really needs to be used there. Shamefast. That means simply there is a sense of shame. That's what the priests were to have as they approached the altar. A sense of shame about their bodies. Not to expose their nakedness. That's what women are to have. A sense of shame about their bodies. Not to expose their nakedness. This sense of shame leads to the modest apparel. Put on, you dress yourself modestly with shamefastness, a sense of shame. Doing it with a sense of shame. And also, modesty is founded in this sobriety. This version uses the word moderation. And again, I fear we've lost the real meaning. The American Standard Version uses the word sobriety there. She's to attire herself not only with shamefastness, or that sense of shame, but also with sobriety. She's in control of what she's thinking about, what she's doing with her life, what kind of an example she is. She's thinking about that all the time. There's sobriety. There's an inner self-government. And she's allowing that to control what she does, how she attires herself. But also, he's emphasizing that this woman is godly.
She's doing good works. She's not concerned about the physical, just like Peter was trying to encourage. But verse 11 now, let the woman learn in silence. I fear that we've lost the meaning there also. I've heard preachers and I've heard Christians say that means the woman just says nothing. That's not the meaning of this word. There's a quietness about the demeanor of this woman, this godly woman. She's not super outgoing and flashy and gaudy. She's concerned about being godly, using sobriety and shamefastness in her conduct and how she attires herself. She's learning in this quietness, this reservedness, perhaps is a good word, this reservedness that she has. It's essential to pleasing God. Well, the same thing I said applies to men. Let's look at some passages together. Next chapter, 1 Timothy, the third chapter, and look at verse 1 and 2, especially verse 2. He's talking about the elders and their qualifications, and he uses the word there, the word modest, but it's not translated that way. It's same root word, same identical word. The bishop must then be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior. There's the word, or some of yours render that orderly. This man is to be of good behavior. He's to be modest. Now, of course, it refers to his demeanor, but that's what we've been talking about back here. Her demeanor, the woman's demeanor, is under consideration, as well as what happens when her mind is in control, when she's in control of what she's doing. Outwardly, it's going to take care of itself. Same thing with the godly man, with the elder. He's a modest man. He's in control of his demeanor, of his life, and how he's going to live. It's a harmonious arrangement of life that he has. It can be seen in what he does, how he treats others. Now, I say that's for the elders, but that ought to be just as good for all the rest of us. If it's important that an elder have that quality, what about the rest of us? Why not? We ought to be the same way. This word shamefast. Hebrews, the 12th chapter. Hebrews 12 and verse 28. Only two times this word shamefast is used in the Scriptures. And this is the second time. Hebrews 12 and verse 28. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with, and here's the word, reverence. Reverence is the word, and godly fear. He might as well have said, receiving the kingdom acceptably with shamefastness. Same word, just translated differently. It's an attitude of mind that we have as we ponder our relationship with our God and with each other, with everybody around us, and especially as Christians here, serving our God with reverence, shamefastness, a sense of shame about ourselves and where we stand, what we can do for ourselves. That's what he's talking about. Doing that also with godly fear. And the word sobriety, go back to Titus. Titus, the second chapter, the word sobriety is used numerous times. We'll talk about that later this week. But in chapter 2, it's used numerous times down through the passage there, referring to older men, younger men, older women, younger women, all of which are encouraged. You can read it on your own, but the first 12 verses there use the word sobriety or sober-mindedness several times. And he's encouraging all of us, young and old alike, male and female, all of us to have this sobriety of life. Sobriety concerning our demeanor of life. Same thing with the word meekness. A woman is to attire herself using meekness. This quietness that she's to have. It's exactly what Jesus uses in Matthew 5 and verse 5. Blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. Same word. Same word. And all of us are encouraged to be meek. It refers to our demeanor again. All of the things that we do, all the decisions that we make, all the thoughts that we have. Meekness is to be a part of our life. And quietness, the same thing. 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 11, Paul uses that word. That quietness that the woman is to have is also encouraged of the men. Verse 11, that you aspire to lead a quiet life. There's that reserved life. In control of yourself, life. In control of your mind. In control of what you do. And to mind your own business, he says. And to work out, or to work with your hands as we commanded you. All of us ought to be more reserved and quiet and useful to the Lord and useful to each other. That's the lesson that we need to learn. So I'm saying, and I'm sorry, I forgot to pull this down, but there's the scriptures we just looked at that apply to the men. Let's get nitty-gritty now. Let's put to practice some of the things that we've talked about. Ask yourself the question, is what you wear, is it in good taste? Or is it gaudy? Does it please the Lord, or does it attract attention? Is it quiet and reserved, or is it flashy, attention grabbing? That's what we're talking about. Secondly, is it reserved, or is it revealing what you wear? I think the questions are good for men too. Is it reserved? Or is it revealing? Revealing your body, that is. Does it create respect? Or does it create passion? These are some pretty hard questions. You let them really sink in. Ought to make some changes, perhaps, in our lives. Now, I say again, I don't even know you. But I hope that you're thinking seriously about it. Let's get a little bit more nitty-gritty. Stand in front of a mirror with what you have on. See what you can see. Sit down in front of the mirror. Cross your legs. What do you see? Is that what you want the men to see? Who are not your husbands? Is that what you want them to see? Now stand up. Bend over in front of the mirror. What do you see? From the rear, from the front. Is that what you want the men to see? If that isn't good enough, do it in front of your husband. Let your husband decide. Does he want the other men seeing what he's seeing? You know, we ought to stop and think about what we're doing. What we're seeing there from the various vantage points ought to be very revealing to us as to where our heart really is, what our purpose is. Are we following the Mary Quant mindset? Are we following Sarah's mindset? And she tried to submit herself to Abraham, and whose daughters you can be if you trust in God like she did. There's some contrasts I want to share with you in conclusion tonight. Some scriptural contrasts. Go with me to Genesis 3.
Genesis, the third chapter, you remember that God has placed Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden.
and he's given them responsibilities, and they have failed. They made the mistake of doing something that was forbidden, and as a result now, their eyes are open. They cannot believe what's happened to them. Verse 7, the result of their eyes being opened, it says, they knew that they were naked. And look what they did. They sewed fig leaves together, made themselves coverings. They now realize they're naked, and they try to cover themselves. We want to cover this nakedness. Hadn't come to this realization before. Hadn't even been a thought. But sin now is a part of their life, and so it's very revealing to them. So they're ashamed now in verse 7. In verse 8, they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and Adam and his wife, what? Hid themselves. They're really ashamed. They don't want anybody to see them, and especially the Lord. They hid themselves. They're afraid. Dropping on down to verse 10, the Lord's asking them where they are and what the problem is. And they're saying, well, I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. Well, why do you think you're naked? Who told you you were naked? See, it's revealing, isn't it? They've been involved in sin, and it's coming out in how they conduct themselves. So they begin blaming each other, but what I want you to see is that their attempts to cover themselves was not sufficient. Not sufficient. The Lord came along, and in verse 21, you have just an inkling of what he did. Also, for Adam and his wife, the Lord God made tunics of skins and clothed them. The first, listen to me, the first animal sacrifice to be offered. The animals offered to cover their sins, and the skins that were left were used to cover their bodies. Lord wasn't pleased with their attempts to cover themselves. He covered them and made a sacrifice for them all at the same time. So what we try to do sometimes is just a little bit short of what the Lord expects of us. I think that's a lesson that we can see from this. Deuteronomy, the 22nd chapter, in verse 5, there's another contrast. In an age where there's a lot of wearing of the same type of clothing, this, I think, is important for us to look at. This is in the old law, I admit to you. It says in verse 5, a woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man. Nor shall a man put on a woman's garment. For all those who do so are an abomination to the Lord your God. Now you know what that refers to. It doesn't refer to things that necessarily can be worn today unisexually. But it's actually a man wearing a woman's clothing. It's a known woman's garment. And vice versa. That's what was prohibited then. I recall several years ago in Massachusetts, there was a young man, part of the congregation. His parents were, I should say, and he was reluctantly there. But he called me one day. He hadn't been worshiping with us for a while, and we'd been trying to get a hold of him and didn't know what to do and where he was. And he called me one day from a bar. He had joined the homosexual community. And he explained to me on the phone that he was going to the gay bars and having a good time. He was enjoying himself. He was dressing like a woman and enjoying all the attention that the men were giving to him. That's the thing that's prohibited here. The mixing of the two. There's to be a distinction, obviously. An obvious distinction between male and female, and we've got to keep that. I cite that passage for that purpose. Go with me now to Proverbs, the 11th chapter. Proverbs, the 11th chapter. Another contrast. Not such a nice one, but there's a lesson here. Proverbs 11 and verse 22. Solomon says, "As a ring of gold in a swine's snout, so is a lovely woman who lacks discretion." We were talking about pigs this afternoon. I have another pig story. You didn't hear the first one, but you're going to hear the second one. When I was on the farm with my parents, we used to, at least once a year, what we called ring our hogs. We'd drive them into a triangular shaped place where there were two gates together, and nose first, and get their nose up in there and clamp them in from the back. They couldn't get out. And we had these pliers that had rings, small, much smaller than that, but we'd clamp those metal rings into the nose. Some of you have probably experienced that, been a part of it, I don't know. But we used to ring our hogs at least once a year. And the young pigs would always get those little rings on each side of the nose. The express purpose of that is to fight the instinct of the pig. The instinct of the pig is to root. Ruin a lot. I mean, just literally ruin it. And just roots and roots. There's nothing to stop it except these rings. They seem to stop a little bit. So you put those rings in your nose, and boy, that pig goes out of that place. He's got his head up in the air. Looks like he's proud, but he's not. He's hurting. But you know, it's not very long. Not very long, and that pig's out there rooting again. And a little bit later, when the pig is bigger, they put a big one in the nose like this. The big ones stick out. But you know, you let the pig go long enough, you know what happens to that ring or any of those rings you put in there? The pig will literally either wear the rings out or tear them out of his nose. Literally. The instinct is there, and you're fighting that instinct. Now, look what Solomon's saying here. With that instinct in mind, Solomon is saying, my page is blown, as a ring of gold in a swine's snout, so is a lovely woman who lacks discretion. No one in his right mind would put a gold ring in a pig's nose. No one. You know what's going to happen. You're either going to wear it out or lose it. Nobody would be that foolish. But he says that's exactly where the woman is, the lovely woman, the beautiful woman, who what? Lacks discretion. Now, Solomon, that's one of the beauties of the Proverbs. Solomon can just so simply, quickly sum up everything that we've said here tonight in one verse. And he's done it. Everything that applies to how the woman's supposed to tie herself, take care of herself, the demeanor that she's supposed to have is summed up here by Solomon. He says, lacking discretion. If she has discretion, she has all these qualities. She has this shamefastness. She has this sobriety about her. Now, the lovely woman who lacks all those qualities in attiring herself is like putting a gold ring in a hog's snout. Doesn't make any sense, does it? It doesn't make any sense for our women either. Then we've already talked about this, so I won't spend much time with this one. We've talked about the outward versus the inward man. The concern that both Peter and Paul had about emphasis on the inward heart, on the inward man, on the heart. and not on the outward man. The outward man will take care of itself. We just need to make sure that the heart is right, the inward man. But then, one last one is that of the attire of a harlot versus that of a Christian. Go with me to Proverbs, the 7th chapter. Proverbs 7. There's something here that we all need to look at and think about, and I want to kind of leave this thought with you tonight. Here is the detestable nature of the harlot. And we know what the harlot is. The harlot is described. We see the kind of person that she is. She's one who is going to do everything she can to entice or seduce a man. Now, that's where Mary Quant is. That's where her clothes are designed to lead women who wear them. Seduce a man. And so she's crafty about this whole thing. Verse 6, for at the window of my house I looked through my lattice and I saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding. One who didn't know what was going on. And this crafty woman is working on him. Passing along the street near her corner, he took the path to her house. In the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot. And crafty in heart. I want you to look at what Solomon puts alongside of this harlot's attire. He puts alongside of that the crafty heart. The heart's not right. Doesn't that emphasize what we've been talking about tonight? What Peter and Paul have both said? The heart is the point of emphasis. It's the point of focus. Get the heart right. The outward man will be okay. Here's a woman that had her heart right. She's crafty in heart. And that's the reason she's wearing the clothing that she's wearing. She's loud. Look at verse 11. This emphasizes the thing just the opposite of what we've been talking about from Paul and Peter tonight. She's loud. She's rebellious. She's not quiet and reserved. Her feet would not stay at home. And at times she was outside. At times in the open square. Lurking in every corner. That's her character. That's her character. She doesn't care what happens. She's after the man. For all the wrong reasons. And she has all this seductive speech that she shares with this young man. I have peace offerings with me today. I've paid my vows. Look at how pious I am. So I came out to meet you. To meet you! Diligently to seek your face. And I found you. I spread my bed with tapestry. Colored coverings from Egyptian linen. I perfumed my bed. All the things that sound so nice and lovely. And you know the rest of the story. She lures the young man. He yields to the temptation. But here's the one that's crafty in heart. Her heart's not right before God. The focus is not on the heart. It's on the outward man. And that's just the reverse of what it ought to be. I hope you have seen in the lessons tonight that the emphasis is obviously on the woman's attire. But it pertains to the men also. But particularly in the connection with the women, that the men should not be looking to lust. And I realize, and I didn't say this to you, but I realize that if you were the most godly person, you used the most sobriety that was available, the most shamefastness that you could ever muster together, and attired yourself the very best way that you could, possibly, there's still some ungodly man out there that's going to look at you to lust. I know that. You know that. But the thing that you need to be focusing on is the heart, like these men have told you tonight from God's Word. Focusing on the inward man. Getting the inward man right, and then all the other things are going to take care of themselves. The godly men that look at you will not look to lust. They'll not be encouraged to look to lust. They will not be enticed that way. They'll not be seduced. Get the emphasis where God wants it. Men, the same thing applies to you. Get the emphasis on the heart. You won't be revealing your nakedness. I'm not here tonight to give you any lines to draw. We can make our own lines based on God's Word, and I hope that they're going to be reasonable lines that you draw. But you'll think soberly. You'll use the shamefastness that Paul's encouraged here. But make sure that we're encouraging things that are not after the flesh, rather after the Spirit. If you're here tonight and there's some thing that you need to change, I want to encourage you to do that. I want to encourage you to make that right with God and His people. You know, some of the strongest lessons that can be preached are not from the pulpit. They're not from the pulpit. They're from the pew. They're from you, by you. How you live every day is vitally important. How I live as an individual is vitally important. I can get up here and say a lot of things, but living it is something else. Those are strong lessons that we can preach. I want you to think about that. If you're not preaching that kind of powerful lesson, change your life tonight. Make it right with God tonight and with His people as we stand and sing this invitation song.